We have some time for some questions, and Carl has the microphone, and if you'd wait, how about this gentleman right over here, Carl? Yeah. And if you make it a short question and indicate who it's addressed to.
This question is for both the panelists. Can you hear me all right?
Yep.
I have here in my hand a little write-up from Brand X. That would be the Hoover Institute. And
we have lots of friends with the Hoover
Institute. We do.
And I was very surprised. I'm a total free market here, like most people here, but I was very surprised to read, according to John Cassidy, writing in the New Yorker, that Hayek supported the idea was when the market, you know, in general, the market is the most efficient method of providing goods and services. When the market fails, however, the government should step in. And therefore, Hayek believed in the guaranteed minimum income. And I'm just curious if that squares with the speaker's understanding. And then the second question, and I run the risk of being a watermelon guy for this, and that is, and the same idea, when the market fails, government steps in. Just referring to the remarks of the professor on conservation, what does he think about the commons? What would Hayek think about the commons problem, external costs, the need for government to, you know, say impose gasoline taxes, that sort of thing? Thank you very much.
I think that Hayek did have the. he certainly said throughout his works that in an advanced industrial society, government should provide a social minimum, and that's why, as I indicated, it's. His not so much his practical policy advice that's often valued by conservative economic and libertarian oriented writers, but his philosophical thought so cannot be denied. Now, he would say that he'd like to see less government rather than more market provision of welfare services, but nonetheless he did sanction that role of government. In regard to the environment as well, these are difficult areas in which it's hard to enunciate principles in terms of whether it's air pollution or whatever the situation might be, and I don't think that Hayek's contributions in these areas were as significant as his contributions in more philosophical areas.
Right. Let me follow up on that. As Alan points out in his book, the early Hayek had a larger list of things that he thought that was appropriate for government to do than the older Hayek.
Well, he was originally a socialist. So.
Even after the road to serfdom. Adam Smith. By the way, the Smith Center doesn't refer to Adam Smith. It refers to, although I'd be happy with that association, it refers to Owen and Irma Smith from Castor Valley, who were the ones that endowed the center at the university. But Adam Smith himself had a rather extensive list of appropriate, what he thought would be appropriate government functions, and the early Hayek, I think, would have seemed to agree with practically all of that list. Well, as technology evolves, the things that are necessary for government to do, especially with regard to the environment, get less and less and less. Because the problem with the externality problem, the environmental problems, the problems of the commons, to use the questioner's language, have to do with the ability to define and enforce exchangeable property rights. And technology is evolving now, which is greatly shrinking that set of things where it is difficult, i.e. very costly, to enforce exchangeable private property rights. For example, there's a tagging technology now that you can use to keep track of migrating animals, even in the sea. Of course, you can do that on the land very easily. So Hayek did subscribe to a rather substantial list, a list that's longer than my list, of a legitimate government. I'm not an anarchist, by the way. Murray Rothbard, whom many of you know about, was referred to himself as an anarcho-capitalist. He was a great friend of mine. I broke bread with him and his wife, Joey, many times, and he always very laughingly called me a minarchist. You know, I'm not an anarchist, I'm a minarchist, because I had some, there are some legitimate things for government to do. See, I didn't agree with Murray on that. And Hayek didn't, and even Mises didn't. Even Mises didn't. Rothbard called himself a Misesian. As a matter of fact, he was there's an organization at Auburn University called the Mises Institute, and Rothbard was very closely associated with that before his untimely death. And Murray sometimes came across as saying that whatever is in Mises is okay and whatever isn't in Mises is not okay. As a matter of fact, a couple of times Murray even went to attack Hayek because Hayek wasn't sufficiently Misesian. So I'm more with Hayek than I am with Rothbard on this issue. There are legitimate things for government to do. For example, enforce the rules of voluntary exchange. Now, Hayek referred to, as Alan says in his book, he referred often to the thing called, what he liked to refer to as the universal rules of just conduct. Well, if you look at what he meant by the universal rules of just conduct, those are just the rules of voluntary exchange. When we talk about the role of government in enforcing, having any role at all in interpersonal interaction, it is merely, according to Hayek, at least the later Hayek, to enforce those rules of voluntary exchange. So Hayek grew, improved, I think, with age on this topic.
One other thing I might mention in reference to the two-part question he had is that, as Chuck is suggesting, over time Hayek did begin to see the implications of his thinking as you'd apply it to more and more specific things, and where he didn't, and where there might have been, in other words, his views on certain government programs were in many respects not necessarily driven from his views. But many other scholars have now applied his analysis, and one of those areas is the environment. That you might even say that where you have a commons problem, it's because property rights are not being recognized and enforced, right, and hence you have the free rider effects and externality. How about right here in front? Uh-huh. Just wait for the microphone.
The Austrian School of Economics has sort of competed with the Chicago School for the better part of a half century. And certainly the Chicago School, under the auspices of Milton Friedman, have enjoyed greater success, at least in terms of how they're received by the general public. Most people have never heard of an Austrian. And it seems to me that one of the biggest problems Austrians face is articulating a policy difference from what the Chicago School does. There are some antitrust issues, and I think that there is also a money Federal Reserve question out there. But for some reason, certainly the Federal Reserve has never caught on. And I'm wondering if there's something that Austrians need to do to better express that, and whether or not there are other policy areas that the Austrians need to pursue further.
Alan has asked me to reply first. I don't think there are very many differences between the Chicago School and the Austrian School when it comes to policy. The one exception that I know of has to do with money. You know, Hayek and Friedman were both co-founders of the Mont-Pelerin Society. And for many, many years, at every meeting of the Mont-Pelerin Society, one of the main questions up for debate was, who's right? Right? Mises and Hayek, or Friedman, you know, the monetarists. And they have substantial disagreements on that point. They have substantial disagreements on the question of methodology of economics. Friedman being a positivist, he wrote that famous, I think it was in 1952, the methodology of positive economics, and
An essay
on positive economics, and Friedman has said, in fact, as Alan quotes in his book, Friedman has said that he likes the work of Hayek much better when it comes to philosophy and social questions than he does in economics. But when it comes to policy, except for the Fed, except for monetary policy, They agree on antitrust. I mean, you take the book that the Independent Institute did on the Microsoft case by Stephen Margolis and
Stan Liebowitz.
The arguments that they're making in there could have been made by Hayek or Friedman. Hayek and Friedman both would have agreed with them.
Friedman,
all of them.
Friedman's used the book.
Yeah. So I don't think there's any policy disagreement except for this quirky thing on money. And to put that into context, as Alan says in his book, Hayek became the Tuck Professor of Economics, or Political Economy, I guess it was, Political Economy at the London School of Economics in 1931, on the basis of some lectures that he gave as a visitor there, which were published as Prices in Production, wherein he talked about what he called the structure of production, and he talked about what now is known as the Austrian monetary theory of the trade cycle. Hayek never, as Alan says in the book, Hayek never gave up on that. Hayek always insisted on that, sometimes contrary to what seemed to be obvious empirical contradictions of it. and Friedman never, Friedman always differentiated himself from Hayek on that, always said that Hayek was wrong. Friedman has said that the Federal Reserve should be replaced by a Pentium chip, yeah. Right? Because he said because discretionary monetary policy makes a mess of things. He would agree with Hayek on that, right? Discretionary policy makes a mess of things. And so that ought to be a rule that increases the money supply at some given level consistent with the level of real economic growth. Hayek, toward the end of his life, wrote this book. Actually, it was a monograph for the Institute of Economic Affairs called The Denationalization of Money. So he, too, would like to see the Fed replaced. In Hayek's case, with private money, and with Friedman's case, a Pentium chip. So there's not all that much disagreement.
Actually, Friedman later endorsed Hayek's, not specific to the proposal in the Denationalization of Money book, but the idea of non-state monetary systems.
Yeah.
Let's see. Are you on the front, Carl?
My question is for Alan. Concerning the infinite fragmentization of ideas throughout the human race, in the last generation, the electron has come in millions of instances to the possession of individuals, and the communications that are available today and becoming more and more available will have a great considerable effect on this fragmentization. Would you care to speculate on what you think will come?
Sure. Well, you know, what do they say? fools rush in where, you know, angels are fear to tread, or something like that. So that's always been my experience. I think that the ability for information to be communicated increases possibilities for centralization. You saw this in the late 19th century, that when the telegraph and other means of communication like that came into existence, that suddenly it was possible to create large corporations, and to those who were first into these new systems of knowledge, or new systems of information communication, were able to take advantage of greater resource manipulation that had not previously happened. And I think that we're experiencing a period somewhat like that now, as a result of the internet revolution, that it's not that someone like Bill Gates is so much more effective. If he'd come along in 1950s, that he'd be worth $70 billion in those equivalent terms. I think it's that it's a unique situation, that when technologies for greater information communication are developed, that for a time is going to, whenever new opportunities exist, there are going to be leaders in that field who take advantage of those opportunities. That leads to larger units of organization for a time, potentially decades. But then I think that after a period of time, those advantages have a tendency to even out, and there's a more there isn't quite the same degree of hierarchical patterns. That's relatively inarticulate, but for speculation, I guess that's as good as I could do.
Can I comment on that?
Sure.
Just a couple of points. Lowering the cost of communication, I think, was very important in bringing down the Iron Curtain. when there was an attempt to have a military coup to reinstall a Stalinist-type government in the Soviet Union, it didn't work. And why didn't it work? It's because the information was coming over fax machines to all over the world what was going on. Secondly, I would say, consider the phenomenon of homeschooling. The low cost of information and communication now has made possible this fantastic phenomenon. There's an article in the May issue of Ideas on Liberty, which is an excellent article, I commend it to you, on a renaissance in education. And the author, who is one of the vice presidents of AOL.com, points out that everything that the public school establishment has in terms of activities for students, orchestras, plays, field trips, everything is available to homeschoolers now because of the internet. It has greatly reduced the cost of people coming together. As a matter of fact, it's homeschooling, I think, is a great example, a great contemporary example of Hayek's spontaneous order. I mean, who would have thought 5 years ago even that homeschooling would become so significant now, so large as it is, and it's growing fast, and it's working very well. So I, just as a little counterbalance, I think that the lowering of information cost is a boon to liberty. It's not a problem.
One thing also, for those of you who were not at our event last month, which was on high technology and privacy and encryption, this is a major part of the discussion. That program will be on our website, I think, within a few days. So if you're interested in exploring that issue, it's discussed in more detail. I think we have time for maybe two more questions. How about back here? You and then Peter.
Hayek and the other liberals have taught us great lessons about essentially two results, or two polar opposite, if you will, statist and liberal societies, which we prefer and why. And I think it's a great thing that we can celebrate that Hayek lived long enough to see the decline of the evil empire, and I agree that information did a lot on that. But at the same time, Manker Olson mm-hmm. taught us mm-hmm. another lesson, which is within a free society, within a mixed economy, there is this accumulation of social, political, economic barnacles on the whole of society. And it seems to be a one-way process. And I guess I'm interested in your reaction to that as an underlying countertrend, and whether there's anything that Hayek and the liberals have to say about how we avoid, how we counter that erosion, not just choosing between statism and liberalism, but how do we combat, how do we react to the accumulation of statist tendencies?
Sure. You know, I think that, and this goes to some extent, questions of epistemology, which for those who may not be entirely familiar with that term, means theory of knowledge. And I think Hayek really talked a lot, he thought a lot about, as I've seen in some of his work, unpublished work at the Hoover Institute Archives, and it's to some extent in some of his published articles as well, on the idea that not all knowledge can be articulated, and that there is a difference between verbal rules and, for example, just the practices that people have. And that words like liberalism and statism, to some extent, aren't material, tangible absolutes in the same sense that matter is. So what we're really talking about is ways of looking at the world in terms of
Is it better to have societies in which decisions are made by everybody, statism, or to have societies in which decisions are made by individuals? And I think that it's something that I agree entirely with Chuck. I think that the direction that things are moving is that there is more individual freedom and autonomy now, that technology allows that. And it's something that, regardless of the terminology, I think that the Hayek used to say that in the 60s and 70s, that if the politicians didn't blow everything up in 20 years, that he thought things would be okay. By the 80s, he started to say, well, if they haven't blown it up in another 10 years, they'll be okay. And let's face it, the Soviet Union has collapsed. The idea that government runs an economy better is dead around the world. And to be sure, the you know, it always resurfaces in other modes, environmentalism and local plan. I mean, local planning controls and so forth. But I think that the overall direction at this point in time for the foreseeable future is, I mean, if you read the literature from the 40s and 50s, just the periodical literature of the day, it's astonishing. People will talk about if people are businessmen, and I mean, this is not over-exaggerating, if people are businessmen, perhaps they have a psychological disorder because they want to make a profit or something like that, or have a need to domineer, and this is the sort of stuff. Now, some of that's still in the in academia, but the point is that there has been just there's been a revolution, and it's something that I don't think the revolution is consolidated, and it's always got to be fought for. But I think that, notwithstanding the issues that government will always be inefficient, it is the most interesting statistic is that under the current administration in Washington's budgets, if all came to pass and another 10 years, the federal spending share of GNP would be down to 15.6%. So, I mean, the point is, I think that whether that goal is met is another question, but it's something that, although I hope it would be, I think it's something that I'm optimistic.
Just 2 points on that question. First of all, I firmly believe that there is no legitimate third way, that the choice is between socialism or liberalism. Classical liberalism, freedom. And there is no third way. With regard to Mansur Olson, and I admire, I mean, he was one of the, James Buchanan credits Mansur Olson as being one of the inspirations for the development of public choice theory. And so he's a very important person. Now, his notion of barnacles and all of that had to do with the formation of special interest groups. And he talked about how when there's a war, a lot of those special interest groups just get smashed up, and so that right after the war there's a chance to really make some progress. Now, a lot of people accused him of advocating war because of that. I don't think he's guilty of that. But my view about special interest groups is probably utopian. Why did dairy interests give lots of money to Richard Nixon in his re-election campaign? Very simple. If Richard Nixon or any other president had nothing to do with dairy prices, had no power over anything in the dairy industry, nobody would have given him a dime. The problem was not Nixon, and the problem was not the people who tried to bribe Nixon. The problem was the fact that in this political economy, Nixon had power. And wherever there's power, there's going to be special interest groups coming together to try to exploit the power. So the only cure to special interest groups, short of war, is to reduce the power that the politicians have to sell.
In your book, you talk about how Road to Serfdom was published to wide acclaim. And yet, for at least 40 years after it was published, in England at least, collectivism was the order of the day. And when I was at Oxford in the 1960s, I never even heard the name Hayek. I mean, it wasn't even in the curriculum. And my question is, did Hayek himself have any explanation for why his ideas took so long to be noticed, in the sense of being incorporated in public policy?
That's a really good question, Peter. In 1970, Arthur Seldon visited Hayek in Salzburg, and Hayek was so depressed at that point in time that he thought his career had been a waste. No one had listened to what he had said, that his writings at that point in time were completely unread, and that he'd had no influence whatsoever. So that's what the circumstance was. I think that what happened was that, and this would be to some extent Hayek's answer, is that as a result of inflation and problems perceived of an increasing government role, that his ideas suddenly became relevant in a way that had not been relevant before, so that it was more the larger circumstances that led to the relevance of his ideas rather than his ideas themselves sparking the change that he had hoped for. So I think that's fair. And then in the 80s, Margaret Thatcher truly embraced him and would invite him to events and all that sort of thing. So.
There's another theory that Ashley Seldon also talked to Hayek about, and other people have asked Hayek about this, was when Keynes wrote his book, The General Theory, Hayek had just refuted Keynes' previous book in a review. And so when The General Theory came up, Hayek assumed it was basically just rehashing the previous work, and he just didn't even pay attention to it and didn't want to be bothered by it. And so the view that was assumed pretty much, of course, there was a lot of political pressures for state planning to be used by different groups for their own purposes, but a lot of people assumed that if Hayek didn't think it was important, that, well, maybe it was okay, maybe there's nothing wrong with it. And so there's a theory that if Hayek had looked at the general theory and refuted it because of his very powerful position at the London School of Economics, it may have stopped Keynes in his tracks and changed the course of economic thought. One other thing I might mention is that, and Alan mentions this in his book, the Friedmans talk about a so-called Hayek tide.
Yeah.
It's sometimes called the Hayek wave also. And the Hayek tide was the idea that at the point of the publication of The Road to Serfdom, which again was dedicated to the socialists of all parties, it was sort of a nodal point in intellectual history. And it created this new wave for people to reconsider fundamental views. And the wave has been washing on shore after shore, decade after decade, in different circumstances, creating other waves in the same way. So there's these paradigms that exist that will continue unchallenged in many respects unless circumstances change, as Alan is saying, and also there's an intellectual basis for an alternative. So I think we're all over time, but I want to thank everyone for joining with us. I want to particularly thank Alan for his excellent work. It took many years for him to produce this book, and it's serving as a great catalyst for other people to be interested in Hayek. I want to thank Chuck for not just his great talk, but for Chuck's work for years and years in a similar vein, and all that the Smith Center is doing. And thank you for joining with us. There are copies of the book for those of you who don't have copies. Alan would be delighted to autograph copies up until the point he has to run to the airport. So thank you for coming.